All right, good afternoon, Tech Ed. It's the very first session. You can't be tired yet. Welcome, everyone, to today's session on getting rid of all of your old stuff so you can get on to the new stuff. I've actually renamed this session, but it was too late to change it in the catalog, so I put it up here, what's on the catalog. But I've got two sessions, and they're kind of a pair, but they're very, very different. The one on Friday is called, oh, hey, Tim, App Compat for Nerds. This is App Compat for Humans, where we try to talk about the stuff that don't require you to be a hardcore geek. This is a very unusual Chris Jackson session in that I will spend exactly 0 minutes inside of WinDBG, and instead we'll be talking about those best practices that help you to move along more quickly. Quick poll, how many of you have someone in your family, whether it's yourself, your spouse, your children, who's afraid of spiders? So just about everyone. Here's an interesting statistic. How many people die every single year on average from spider bites? 4. How many people die each year from stress-related afflictions? 62,000. It is actually worse for your health to be afraid of spiders than to handle spiders. The fear is worse than the reality. And that is very, very true of application compatibility. The fear is paralyzing and worse for you than the actual problem. So what we want to talk about today are what are those practices that help you effectively manage risk so you can do the right thing, because I'm guessing no one wants to be fired when the mission critical application goes down. So you focus on that which truly matters and don't focus on those things that don't matter. To kick things off, one of the first things that we learned, and we learned this big time from Vista, is people have to actually want to get where you're trying to go. Because here's where we are. We're at the tail end of what I call the technology dark ages. A period of about 10 years, very similar to the 13th century, where you could change absolutely nothing about how you run your technology and still be modern enough to get by. Right? You're running Windows XP, you can still be modern enough to get by. Probably not optimal, but it works, right? The Dark Ages. In the past, we used to have all of this practice in moving along. You went from 16-bit to 32-bit, and you survived. You made it. You used to have to go through every couple years. Hey, there's Windows 1, Windows 2, there's DOS, there's various versions of DOS. We had mainframes. We got used to jumping around, and then we just stopped. We stayed still. The platform stayed still for a decade. And now, all of a sudden, there's all these great things that we want to take advantage of, but we've forgotten how to move. The first thing is we've got to actually want to get to where you want to go. And so when we think about getting to where you want to go, I wanted to show a quick video. I think that would not be the correct one. There we go. Quick video to think about what is it that is inspiring you to want to get to the new platform, because that, I think, was one of the big challenges with Vista, is not that it was impossible to get there, it's that no one wanted to. So consequently, you don't get there. So think about, what is it that you're going to get out of it? Here's an example.
Hi, my name is Abby.
Of one reason.
I like debugging programs. One day, doing my homework, I thought, what if I had an operating system that saw the handle to a debug object in the thread environment? To provide native support for debugging. So I invented Windows 7. It was the debug. Uh-oh, this program is broken. Oh, it's still user mode. That's baby stuff. Lily!
That is, of course, exactly what she was doing. I
See? Easy. Windows 7 was my idea, so give me $100 million.
It's always worthwhile to stop and think about it. Why is it that you want to go there? And are the people who you're pushing there inspired to go there? Why is consumerization such a hot topic? Because it's all about end-user pull and end-users having a desire and helping you. And we'll talk about the crowdsourcing aspect of that. I want to think just real specifically a couple of quick examples of what might inspire you in the context of IE. But these principles apply across products. In the space of IE, one of the ways that moving to the latest platform helps you is that it's more resilient, it's more reliable. If something bad happens, it doesn't bring you to the end. We're able to say, hey, well, it looks like that thing had a problem. Let me just go ahead and recover that and bring you back to where it went before without just dropping all of your work. And we will, of course, eventually say, wow, it looks like that program sucks. Would you like to go somewhere else? But we are able to gracefully recover. We're more reliable. We re-architected the product. Tangible benefit that people can see. This is certainly from the nerd perspective, from the super nerd perspective. Right? How many people have ever had to go in and troubleshoot JavaScript code? Right? A few. Your developers will really appreciate this. This is what JavaScript code looks like today because it all gets compressed. If you're the one paying the bandwidth bill, you love seeing code like that because it costs you less money. If you're the one debugging it, you kind of don't like seeing it until you go and select this menu option that we added for IE9 that puts things into neat little functions. So you can read them. Small little things that have a huge benefit. And it's this math. I'm just going to do a made-up demo right now. Oh, that's awesome. What's my user agent? String. I'll just do a random web search and pick whatever comes first, and hopefully it'll do well. This user agent string, right, when you start thinking about benefits and how you can tell this story, there's tons of little stories like this. How many characters is that? That is, let's do, hold on here, word count. That is, with spaces, 78 characters. As opposed to the legacy user agent string we had that makes a point to announce to the world that I somehow am one of the four people that bought a Zune. Oops. Copy. Paste. That's really working well. Right, you're wondering where I'm going with this. When you start doing and playing with the laws of large numbers, 184 minus 78 means I have a difference of 106 characters just in my user agent string. That user agent string gets sent with every web request. How many websites do you think your average user goes to every single day? A couple hundred, right? How many web requests go to build that? Usually about 20 to get all the images, get all the scripts, but let's dumb that down and say it's only 10. How many users do you have in your organization? Right? Let's just take a whack and say 20,000. That's how many characters of data you're saving on your bandwidth bill. That's number of bytes, number of K, that number of meg, that number of gig. 3.9 gigabytes of bandwidth a day you save just by having a shorter user agent string. The law of large numbers brings in surprising savings when you go through an upgrade. That's the kind of change we want to enable. We want to have, here's a tangible benefit that people can see and apply to every single audience. That we have developers who want the product. That we have users who want the product, and that they're helping us. One of the biggest bits of learning that we have. when we talk about the kind of things that makes IT pros excited, how many of you consider yourselves IT pros? So most of you. How many of you consider yourself developers? So about a third versus two-thirds, I'm kind of guessing based upon that. What do IT pros like? We keep it around longer. We provide support. That doesn't mean you should use it to the entire end of time, but there's a new build of Chrome coming out about once every 6 to 8 weeks. A new build of Firefox coming about once every 6 to 8 weeks. If you are responsible for validating it, you're perpetually behind and perpetually out of support. You have the option to be in support on the platform you want so that you can go at your own pace, not at somebody else's. It's more manageable. You have lots and lots of group policies. And the concept always comes up, more is better. And that is, of course, true when you're talking about Ferraris. But when you think about, hey, more is better, I have over 1,500 group policies. In some ways, that's true. In some ways, that's dangerous. About 10% of the bugs that get escalated to my team, which is the escalation team for enterprise software compatibility, are based upon things that are configured differently than the standard. So it's their environment in which the bug comes up and not the product itself. The reason why is that there's such massive complexity. The number of possible permutations of the IE group policies in Windows 7 with IE9 is that. By way of comparison, the number of molecules in the observable universe is that. Policies, molecules in the entire universe. So as you might imagine, we don't have that many test cases. So we've never seen most of those configurations. The security guy that has gone through and decides that they get paid by the number of policies that they change is putting you into a state that no one in the universe has ever seen before. Consequently, that makes it harder. There's a great article that my friend Aaron Margosis wrote called Sticking with Well-Known and Proven Solutions, and it's been my mantra. The closer you stay there, the safer you are. That doesn't mean you shouldn't vary from that ever, just that that's what you should default to unless you have a good reason not to. So taking this concept of figuring out what it is that we want, the next thing that we think about best practices is, what is the overall approach that people are taking? Right, and what we've done is we've gone back to the approach that we used to have. When you were transitioning to Windows 95, what did you do? You found all the Windows 3.1 software that was running your business, Lotus 1, 2, 3, and the like, and you tested them all, and then you migrated, and everything was fine. And so we continue applying that same approach to today's world, which is vastly more complex, and we're finding that this law of large numbers is once again serving, in this case, to hamper us, because it's creating too much work. And one of the things that I like to live by is the law of holes. If you find yourself in a hole, it's time to stop digging. If this approach is no longer working, it's time to think more creatively of a different approach, to be less of a perfectionist. This is hard because we're trained from early childhood to be perfectionists, that there is always a right answer, and we are out there to seek it. What is the right answer? How am I going to find what's absolutely correct? There's actually a really interesting body of research around computer science that talks about, what if we didn't always have to give the right answer? Probabilistic computing. We can run chips with fewer transistors and with a lot less heat if they could be wrong sometimes. But we have a hard time thinking about things being right only probabilistically. But that's what we need to achieve, because the problem is we can never get to a state of perfection. Unfortunately, Mr. Alan Turing proved in 1936 that it will be impossible for us to find all of the bugs in software, and a compatibility bug is nothing more than a bug. It is an unfortunate reality that the world is simply too complex for certainty. And that complexity, while it's annoying when we think about how do we prove it's possible to move forward, ends up being a really good thing for the capabilities of an organization. There's an academic researcher out of MIT, his name is Cesar Hidalgo, that talks about networks and talks about how you can measure the complexity of a society by how many different interconnected parts work together to create a network capable of building products. Think about your PC. What skills does it take to build a PC? And I'm not talking about taking your pre-built Asus motherboard and dropping it in a box that you bought from Case Logic and putting a fan in there. We can all do that. How many of you understand battery technology and could construct a battery that didn't detonate? If I take out the didn't detonate part, I could probably do that. Right? One person could. You're a battery maker. Right? Who can mine the metal that we need and refine it to get what we want? Who's an expert metal smelter? Do we have any of those in here? We have distributed this across a broad network, and the same is true for technology. One of the hardest challenges we faced in IE was not that the engineering challenge was too big. It's that we had three domains that were assembled using a network of groups. You had the cascading style sheets built by the designers using a Mac that never showed up to meetings. You had the JavaScript built by your developers, and you had the HTML built by the tool that you bought from another company, and no one person knew all three. If, as a barrier to entry, you require one person or one team to master all of these technologies, then you underestimate the size of your network and the value of your network. The network makes you powerful. It also lends you unable to understand the entirety of your environment. It's said that Leonardo da Vinci was probably the last person ever that our species will have ever created who could possibly have known all of the knowledge that was in the world to know. We can't do it. If we admit that and say, you know what, we got a network of people, let's leverage the network to get things done, we'll be much more effective. If we use scientific methods to go through trial and error to understand where the problems are, we can start dividing the process much more sensibly. So the four-step process that I advocate when dealing with a platform transition breaks it down into structured testing, organic testing, application governance, and platform exploitation. And I'm going to talk about all of these in detail, but the biggest dichotomy is the first two, and this is where most people get hung up. I used to call it proactive testing and reactive testing. I'm trying out some new naming conventions here because reactive has a strong negative connotation. I don't want to handle things reactively. I want to handle them proactively. We're not trying to pawn off responsibility. We're trying to invest wisely in the really important things, not invest in things that aren't as strategic for us. To figure out, wow, someone really messed that up. I love when my slides go through an edit. There we go. The formula for determining whether it's worth your while to look at something is relatively straightforward. How much is it going to cost if that thing fails? There is some cost to it. And what's the likelihood that it will fail? Multiply them. If the cost of failure multiplied by the probability of failure is greater than the cost of testing, then you should test. If it's less than the cost of testing, you shouldn't bother looking at it because it's not worth your time. It's hard for people to get their head around that for a couple of reasons. Number one, the notion of I'm not going to test it seems weird, right? I've had a couple of objections to this when I first brought up the idea. I had one person that said to me, listen, I've got an app here that's running on the trading room floor. I mean, it was a big financial institution. They said, if this thing goes down, $10 million a minute are lost. I said, okay, you haven't disproved me. You've just said you belong in the I should probably look at that one bucket. Doesn't mean the rest of the formula doesn't follow. It means that the cost of failure is catastrophic, very, very large, so you'll look at it beforehand. I had another organization, this was a retailer, that said, I can't just decide not to test things. The business would hang me if I did that. You're right. You can't decide not to do that. You can convince them to, though. Buddy of mine was talking to a customer going through an Office migration, and they said, listen, we need to make sure all of this stuff can work. We can't just be out hanging on this one. And someone else looked at him and said, well, we're piloting it right now, and if we call up with a problem, they get it fixed in about half an hour at worst, usually in a couple of minutes. They said, could you wait half an hour? He's like, oh, yeah, I could wait half an hour. Then don't test it ahead of time. If you want to start working out some of the math, the hard part is figuring out what the cost of failure is. That's all very abstract. The probability of failure, I advocate tracking it, what's happening in your organization, because there's a really huge standard deviation. Some people are really lucky, some very unlucky. It kind of depends. As a rule of thumb, if a lot of your things say for Windows NT, you're probably really unlucky. Probability that a Windows app will fail going from Windows XP to Windows 7, statistically speaking, large standard deviation, is about 28%. Probability that a IE app going from IE 6 to IE 9, statistically speaking, about 24%. Most of those really easy to fix. We'll talk about that in my nerd session, which is on Thursday. And the probability that an app going from Office 2003 to Office 2010 is a little bit less than 3%, really, really small. And then I track what happens in my environment because, as I said, there's quite a lot of variation, but I apply the same bit of logic. This dichotomy, dividing them up and saying you are not good enough to test, feels like a value judgment when it's not. It's a pure business decision. There are ways to put it. When I talk about how do we help people understand what it means, it should go in structured if you have to say, you know what, my pager is going to start going off if this thing goes down. Or I'm going to get called before Congress if something happens here, which does happen. Versus, I just want to make sure you take care of it, but I can wait half an hour. Then I can drop it and handle that organically and use a more crowdsourced method. No one's going to lose their job if business will continue forward. To me, it's all about what would you have to get out of the way first to start a pilot. And once you start the pilot, then you just keep going as long as you've got bandwidth. And this organic testing all comes from the concept of crowdsourcing, which is working extremely well in all aspects of our world. Great story of how we're using crowdsourcing. This is actually not our stuff, so I'm actually plugging someone else's stuff, but I love the solution. City of Boston has a bite of snow. Also, occasionally things catch fire there. Turns out that when things catch fire, it's handy to have the fire plug be accessible. But having a government agency commissioned to go around and digging out fire pumps turns out to not be super effective. So there's a program that they built that takes computer scientists from famous firms and says, you're going to come and do this internship to go and do some good for government. And what they came up with here was, what if we crowdsource this? What if we let people adopt a fire hydrant, take responsibility for shoveling it out, and if they don't shovel it out, then they'll lose ownership of that fire hydrant and someone else gets to claim that fire hydrant. And believe it or not, that worked. People go out and shovel off the fire hydrants. They take ownership. They've crowdsourced it. Far more effective than building up a whole agency to go around the very inefficient process of getting to all the fire hydrants and digging them out one by one. Same thing for your apps. There are some things you will never run a single day of a new platform without making sure that they work, because the cost of that failure is catastrophic. But there are other things where someone can test it out and they'll be so thrilled to get the platform that they're like, you know what, I'll call you if there's a problem and you can help me out. Crowdsourcing. So let's talk about best practices in each of these buckets. When we think about structured testing, how is it that we go through and do this most effectively? The first thing I always think about is understanding what knowledge we want to own and what knowledge we don't. And then let's make sure we start off with the knowledge we want to own. right? And I differentiate this because there are a number of tasks that are extremely technical that require a long time to build. So if I think about a Windows application, a Win32 application written in C++, troubleshooting that, I've got no source code most of the time, usually requires me to get in there with the debugger and dig underneath, understand how Windows works, understand how the debugger works, be able to read x86 or even worse, x64 machine code, and translate that and execute against that. How long does it normally take to build up those skills? When I recruit for my team, I allocate between 6 and 12 months, depending upon the person, and most of those people have done that in the past. 6 to 12 months for a task that the average customer ends up using for less than a week. So it doesn't make a lot of sense for me to build up that knowledge. But what I'd love to build up is the knowledge of how to solve the easy problems quickly. What breaks all kinds of stuff for someone coming from Windows XP to Windows 7 in the typical configuration? The fact that there's a lot more people running a standard user. UAC enabled, whether or not people are admins, most of the time you're running without admin rights, and most customers are trying to run a greater percentage of their clients with non-admin rights. Let's make sure we own that knowledge so that when issues come up, we know it, we understand it, we'll bring that in. So kick it off, beef up my knowledge, know what I want to own the knowledge of at the very beginning, and then figure out what it is that we need to look at, the act of discovery. And I've actually been trying to change the language here because historically we said inventory, and inventory has this connotation of I've got to find it all. And got to find it all is a little bit of a risky proposition because all is a rather large number. I don't want to find it all. I want to find the stuff that matters. Right? Now, when we think about finding all of it versus finding the stuff that matters, one very interesting conundrum is this. People are holding you accountable for keeping their stuff working, but you don't know that you're responsible for it. You don't know what it is. This is an odd little bit of insurance that they've done. IT is insuring an application you don't know about. So here's what the business has done. They said, I've made an app, I've deployed the app, I've not told you about it, but if it breaks, I'm going to have your neck. That's pretty fair. So when I talk about discovery, I also talk about this should be the last time you do discovery. Because you shouldn't be held accountable for something that no one's told you about. And it's a two-way street. They should be telling you about it if they want you to be responsible for it. And you should be making it easy for them to tell you about it if you want them to bother. How do we get things actively maintained, submit a plan for them so that we know what's critical and we can always be aware of it and we can be actively monitoring it as we go? When we talk about testing, we look at what's the most efficient way to find the bugs and through any different method. Within Microsoft's consulting services, we do what we call industrialized testing. Factory, call it what you will. There's plenty of implementations that don't use that, and that's fine. But it's all about finding the cheapest path to surface the most bugs the most quickly to get it to the user without annoying them. All of the testing that comes before user testing, I don't consider testing. I consider user cooperation management. How do I not piss off my user by having him walk in, double-click on the icon, and it blows up and doesn't even install? Because how quick are they going to come back the next time if that happens? But if I've never in my life run a mutual fund, how am I going to tell if some mutual fund management software works? Right? I'll pick on my friend Tim. I've never run an amusement park. How do I know if the amusement park, God, I don't even know what they run over there, but how do I know if that stuff works? I've never run a television studio. How do I test if that works? I've never done food processing for, you know, a large multinational food chain. I can tell you, does file print work? But that doesn't necessarily answer the question. All of the work that happens beforehand is all about making it easy for the user and finding the obvious things But getting users to have a friction-free experience, we're still going to end up doing that crowdsourcing. We're just going to do more work up front because we want to make double, triple, and quadruple sure that everything works. So we are not overly disruptive while not being paralyzed. We want to balance between take some risks, but don't be foolish. Once you get through this pile of applications, then is the time to start looking at opening up a pilot, right? And seeing how we can get more seats quickly deployed in this pilot. One of the greatest stories, actually got a couple of them, around this concept of user opt-in, user volunteers. One of them was managed. It was a transition. They were doing XP and IE6, step one, XP and IE8, step two, Win7 and IE8. With IE, it was super easy for them to roll back. So here's what they did. They went through, they found all the stuff that had to work before anyone could have it, tested it, and then said, green light, you can go. And then as long as the help desk had bandwidth, they kept processing the request. And you would call the help desk. They weren't even advertising. Word of mouth, call the help desk. Hey, can I get IE8? Sure. And if they had not enough bandwidth, they would say, yeah, but you're going to have to wait a couple weeks until we get caught up. And they kept proceeding. And using this opt-in method out of, I think they had about 80,000 seats total, they deployed 56,000 seats. Volunteer, I'd like this, please. One of my favorite Windows 8 stories, I don't have them as a case study, so I can't name them, but it's a technology company, so their technology companies are a little bit different. They were still running XP as a technology company. They were building up their Windows 7 image and threw it up on a file share somewhere, because I guess they ran out of hard drive space, and they didn't secure the file share. Someone stumbled across it and said, oh, great, finally we have our Win7 image. I'm not waiting for the advertisement to come out. I'm going to install it. Told his buddy. They did an inventory a little while later. The entire company was one-third deployed using the unsecured file share method. Not that that's how I recommend deploying Windows 7, but this end user pull, this end user opt-in can be extremely powerful. Enable the pilot, then open it up, measure how happy people are. Are you targeting people? Do you need more training? I had a long conversation with some folks, a group of folks from one of the organizations attending here today, talking about, we're looking at Windows 8. We're looking at the training. How are we going to help people figure out this whole really different experience? Well, you're going to think about that beforehand to enable that, but let people opt in. Are there scenarios where that makes a lot more sense to target first and do a mix between targeting and not targeting and then track it and see how far you're going? We have this problem big time at Microsoft because we love numbers. We also are lazy because most people are, so we love the easy to collect numbers. So when we look at AppCompat, we look at how many apps do we look at, how many debug sessions do we do, and blah, blah, blah. And none of that actually matters. There are two numbers that matter around AppCompat. Number one, how many seats did I get done and are now running the new platform? And number two, how much was I able to contain the cost of that? And that's it. Everything else is ancillary. It's tracking the process, helping the project manager contain the cost. But the real numbers are how many seats. And I want to have plans that get me seats and be planning my compatibility activities. I don't want to just randomly pick apps across the board but don't allow groups of people to go. I want to light up organizations and let them go and find more and keep going and move into the organic testing phase, the ability to support that. When we talk about organic testing, it's all about someone has an issue. How do we get them back up and running quickly? Right? If it's a Windows application, great, you're broken. Wait, no, that's not great. That's horrible. You're broken. Let's get you working again. Citrix box, Windows 2003, your app's working. Wow, I hate running Citrix on Windows 2003, so let's hurry up and get that fix put in place. Let's get someone attacking it. Let's resolve it as fast as we can. Unblock you, and then unblock you in a better way. Think about modernizing the application. And then start analyzing that to figure out what is it that we're doing within this organization. This is one thing that I've noticed, right? So my job for the past 6 years has been to go from company to company worldwide, I do about 210,000 miles a year, so I usually get to sit up in the front, which is kind of nice. and just visiting tons of customers. About one a week, about 50 a year, so what is it, close to 300 different customers I've been able to visit so far. And one of the things that I've noticed is development teams always complain that people don't share code. But you know what they're awesome at sharing? All of their bad code. If you've got code that has a compatibility bug, if it does a version check, you will copy and paste that into everything and put that everywhere. What are the commonalities? What are you doing, and how can we address that by putting in new standards to catch that and stop making that mistake? How do we go back and do some analysis to target that with training and knowledge sharing as we continue to go through and learn? So this needs some oversight as well. It's not just about getting there. It's about finding the cheapest way to improve the application ecosystem moving forward. And there are two ancillary parts that I always like to include and think about when we're dealing with an entire application portfolio. The first of those is governance. Like I said, the average organization starts out today with step one, figure out what I'm on the hook to support because I don't know. And that's a pretty scary place to be. I don't know what I'm responsible for keeping working. How do you succeed at that job? So we start thinking about what are the components of doing governance. And when I think about it, I divide it usually into three different categories of ways I can approach the problem. Category number one, how do we start putting in some quality bars that ensure that I'm not continuing to persist in the same challenges? For example, if I am planning a move to Windows 7 IE9, it's not going to happen tomorrow. There's going to be a lot of work involved in that. I want to avoid the scenario in which I start doing all of this planning and all of this work, get to the point where I've done all of my proactive testing. Most people err towards doing more than they probably need to, but that's okay. It's better than less than you need to. And get done. Start to deploy and realize that someone has inadvertently created new applications in the interim that don't work on the new platform that I was not aware of because I did my inventory 12 months ago. How do I put in a bar that says stop putting out stuff that doesn't work on this new platform? We're not fully deployed. It still needs to work on the old one, but it can't not work on the new one. How do I put in a quality bar that says you can't not work for non-admins? In the space of IE, how do I put in a quality bar that says, stop making new Quirks mode websites? Which is based on an implementation of HTML standards that came out in 1999, not exactly fresh. The middle category is one that most people have some awareness of, which is license management. How do I make sure I'm not going to get sued to oblivion? The third part is, more strategically, how do I manage those applications which I can use for strategic value to help understand how I'm using my platform? And then starting to think about the future, which is how do I exploit the platform that I'm moving to? How do I understand what it is that's now possible and start using it? When I think about Windows 8, my Windows 8 strategy, I can tell you what most of the enterprise customers I talk to so far are thinking about it. I don't talk to a lot of people like, I am going to deploy everyone on Windows 8 on day one. That's not usually the conversation I have. The conversation I normally have is, Windows 8 hits some scenarios that I can't hit today. A lot of my mobility scenarios in particular. I'm not planning to put everyone on it, but I want to hit that scenario right away. The fact that it's Windows 8 doesn't mean it's going to start hitting those scenarios. I need to start building for the new platform. Windows 8 without Metro apps isn't really Windows 8. It kind of looks a lot like Windows 7 without a button. How do I build for that? If I think about IE9, it's possible to write grungy old HTML3 code if you want to and have it render using the Quarks Mode engine, it's possible to write HTML5. Which one should you be writing? How do we get people to start doing that? Because it doesn't happen automatically. How do we provide that training so that people are aware of that? And there are short-term and long-term benefits to that. Short-term, i.e. is the one with the pronounced short-term benefit. An interesting statistic, I'll go look it up real quick, because I was curious. Because I had someone walk in to one of the sessions I was giving. I was over in London working with a customer, and someone came in and he said, listen, IE9 is supposed to be fast. I'm running this app. Here it is on Firefox. Here it is on IE. Look at how much faster Firefox is. And so the first thing that I did was I said, all right, well, let's take a look at which engine you're using, because if I use F12, I can see, oh, he was using Quarks mode. And I said, I wonder if Quarks mode is as fast as standards mode. Since it worked in Firefox, it was probably going to work in IE standards mode. And so I just switched it and put it into standards mode. This fascinated me. It was faster than Firefox when I did that. So then I said, I wonder if that's across the board. I don't take anyone's word for it, so I tested it. I went to the SunSpider test, which is made by the WebKit guys, which powers Google and Chrome, so it's not even our stuff. And I said, let's try them all. You can see the date because it's Firefox 6. Firefox is now at 13, which means this is at least 4 weeks old. The one joke I've landed so far today, because everyone gets that one. And I started testing them. And IE9, when in IE9 mode, was doing fantastic. Did it always win? No, it doesn't always win. It's always very competitive. But when I take it up against Quarks mode, it's 10 times slower. 10 times. On IE10, it's only twice as slow. But there's some immediate benefit. My stuff goes faster. There's some long-term benefit, too. When you think about hiring, how many of you have to maintain mainframe code? Probably some of you. He has a couple hands, right? There's probably someone in your organization responsible for doing that. How many college kids are you hiring to do that? Not a lot come out knowing how to program mainframe code at all. How many know COBOL? Not a whole lot. What about the web? How many college kids come in going, you know what? I love IE. It's all I've used. I program for IE5.5 all the time. That's what Quarks mode is. So it powers 70% of enterprise websites. Long term, it's going to be a mainframe problem. No one's going to speak that language. We need to find some way to gradually evolve and continue getting better. So here's the macro problem. So that's kind of the approach, and I want to talk a little bit about how to get into the head of defining the solution for my organization, because we really have a balancing act. This, by the way, is Plato's Republic, and Plato's Republic has a piece of it that really resonated with me. It's the law of non-contradiction. You can't both be something and not be something at the same time. Customer conversation I had, this is a customer in Turkey. And they had an application that was running just fine on Windows XP for their admins and that was not running on Windows 7 when they wanted to make everybody a non-admin. And they said, I want it to work and I want everyone to be a non-admin. And in this case, it was rather unfortunately a contradiction because they also refused to change the software. It was IBM CICS software. And there were literally, I think, 7 versions newer than the one that they had. They just didn't feel like buying a new one. So they wanted to do nothing with the software, do something with the platform, and have nothing fail. An inherent contradiction. I will not move this. This has rules that can't be changed, and I expect them to work together. And that didn't work out so well. That's a contradiction. So when we think about piecing this together, I like to keep in mind the overall philosophy that Microsoft applies to compatibility, which is, by default, if you possibly can, keep stuff working. But that doesn't mean keep building new stuff on the old technology, which will still work because we have it there to grandfather things in. To build in my assumptions that say, if I'm going to change some things and I run into a problem, that I need to figure out which variable I'll let move. Super common example. A lot of people say, I want one image. It's going to be a 64-bit image, and I'm not going to have a 32-bit image. And they start roaming around their organization, and then they find the pocket of 16-bit applications that nearly everybody has. Now, I've had one customer who I loved this response that said every time one came up, he's like, hey, 16-bit application. That means it's at least 15 years old. You got your money's worth. Move it. Most people don't have that kind of political power. And most people have to either figure out, can they gain that political power and force it, or will they bend and have a 32-bit image? Because you've got to pick one. You either got to fund getting the new one, or you got to bend and put a 32-bit image. But you've got to not expect to build in a contradiction while at the same time leveraging what's available to you. And then think about how to gradually evolve out of the old one. This, for example, takes the starting point of where we are in IE. On average, 70% of all applications running on IE in the enterprise run in Quirks mode. Another 27-28% run in IE7 standards because that's the default in the local intranet zone. And in fact, unless you specifically add a marking, you can't use new technology on your internal websites. So if you're not aware of that marking, by definition, you're not going to get all of the performance benefits of IE9. People need to know about that marking. How do we communicate? I want a new rendering engine, please, because the default tuning for the enterprise is grandfather everything in. So I have to manually opt in. It's what we did for IE6. IE6 had two rendering engines. How many people knew that? Right? Handful. Probably because you moved up and said, oh, hey, wait, I found these two things in 7 or 8 and realized what was happening. When it was out, most people didn't notice. We put in a doc type to let the developer pick which one they used. How many developers do you think I've talked to worldwide that knew what the heck a doc type did? One. Good idea. You can grandfather it in, right? Everything in, but you have to opt into the new technology, and no one knew it. A lot of people were using doc types because Dreamweaver or FrontPage or Visual Studio or blah, blah, blah put it in there for them, but they never thought twice about it. They had no idea they were on the hook to do that. XUA compatible is the new doc type. Most people have no idea they need to do it. And as a result, they continue using the old technology with a plan that says, I would like to gradually retire this by attrition wherever possible, when explicitly targeted, when merited, to gradually evolve myself off of that old platform. When we think about this AppCompat problem, and I alluded to this at the very beginning, the concept of fear, the concept of what was happening, the psychology behind it is actually extremely interesting to me. Incidentally, I did not major in computer science. I majored in psychology, after which I became a disc jockey. After which I figured out that I knew how to program computers for some reason. The concept of the self-fulfilling prophecy, the Pygmalion effect. When you set out to say, we believe we can do this, doing it becomes much easier. When I talk to a customer that doesn't believe in themselves, they go slower and they pay more money. The number one indicator that I can tell whether I'm going to have a good week or a not-so-great week is if I walk into the conference room with the Windows 7 team or the IE9 team or the Office 2010 team, if the people in that conference room in charge of getting you to that platform aren't running it themselves, they believe they can't do it, they're going to go slower and they're going to pay more money every time. We need to figure out ways to get people to have faith that's realistic. We don't want to just be wildly optimistic. I'm not advocating just going out and doing anything like, hey, nothing will go wrong, right? We try that. I always love, the Windows team always comes out with, well, we'll just tell them the compatibility impact isn't that big of a deal. I'm like, you're the boy who cried wolf. You said that for Vista. People don't believe you anymore. You can't just say it's not a big deal. Incidentally, it's not that big of a deal, but unlike Sinofsky, who said, and build, if it works on 7, it'll work on 8. There's a big asterisk next to that one, right? The biggest problem that we see is version checks. Here's an interesting number. So with every single day, we build Windows. It's a daily build. So everyone checks in their code. They run a process. It takes about the same amount of time because Windows keeps growing and growing. So even though our build servers get faster and faster, there's more and more to compile. So it seems like for the past 20 years, it's taken the same amount of time to compile Windows. We build it, and then we run through a bunch of tests to see what applications that worked on 7 still work on 8. As of build, which is the last statistic I have, so therefore it's the other one that I can share because I like my job, the number of applications that worked on 7 that had a problem working on 8 because of an explicit version check, of the, I think it's north of 3,000 I know, 17% version check. Well, the good news is your version lies for Windows 7 will also version lie you for Windows 8. So the same fix will actually carry you forward. But it's not completely a perfect story, but it's a super good one. What you want to do is figure out what to expect, build a plan, measure the plan, and figure out how to create this self-fulfilling prophecy that delivers results, that puts out seeds. When you look at the programs the Windows team invests in, the programs that continue to deliver results are the ones that say, we're going to get 100 seats, which is not a lot for a lot of customers. But that momentum creates a belief in yourself to move forward. And that's not just popping a tool in place to do that. In fact, an interesting little statistic, the number one use, and I'm going to pick on the Application Compatibility Toolkit because Mark is here, who's the program manager for the team. The number one use for the Application Compatibility Toolkit's compatibility evaluators as of 5.6 is I will deploy them to a bunch of machines, gather the data, take the database, stick it in a corner, and never look at it again. Number one use. In fact, that is about the only use for the Office Migration Planning Manager without guidance. That doesn't mean the tools can't be used to good effect. It just means it's easier to use them to scare yourself than it is to use them for good. That's actually driven a lot of change. This realization that what we're trying to do is inform and inspire, that's driven some incredibly positive change. And in fact, Mark and I are presenting on that when? Wednesday. When? At 10:30. To show you how this experience has really affected the products. That I consider to be one of my primary jobs, is to advocate for you to the product team. Right? Because you're a bunch of people yelling loudly, and it kind of sounds like a cacophony. So what I try to do is hear it all and go and visit you and sit down and go, wow, God, that really does suck. We need to fix that, and filter that and get people's voices and connect them directly to have those conversations, much to Mark's chagrin. I give out his email address all the time. I almost gave it away now. Should I? Come to our session and I'll give it away there. To drive that improvement. So you move away from this notion of I used a tool and into a notion of I have data that continues to show me that I'm having good results and reinforces my belief in myself. And this is based upon very sound, measured psychological principles. When you look at the effectiveness and the performance of people, a control group that you take no action on whatsoever gradually improves over time because they get practice. If you give them feedback as they go, they do a little bit better. If you give them goals at the beginning, they do a little bit better. But if I give them goals and give them feedback, I more than double the increase in performance. And that's what we're shooting for. Oh, incidentally, this is for a quick side story. Pygmalion. Try this at home. I was joking before the session about putting things inappropriate on the screen. Not that I ever would. But it turns out that one of the most difficult things in the world to do is to find an image of Pygmalion that I can put on a screen. Google it. The next step is to move away more from Tom Sawyer. And we've talked about this one from time to time. The sense that people have pawned off their responsibility for you. Separation of risk from reward is a problem. I'm going to go and buy software or build software that is not designed to last as long as I would like to run it, but then put IT on the hook to keep it running as long as I want to run it. What's the average lifespan of enterprise software? Would you guess? 12 years. Right, I talked to one customer who said, yeah, we built this application, we expected it to last 4 or 5. We're at year 13, our best guess is 12 more. That's what we're dealing with. So we have this sense of, I have not built something to last for this long, but I'm going to try and make it last that long anyway by giving the responsibility to someone else. So I'm going to build this piece of software, solve this business problem. I'm not going to pay up front for the warranty. I'm just going to give support to someone else who has no money to provide that support, cross my fingers, and hope that works out well. Complete separation of risk from reward. How many bonuses has the IT department got for the problem that is solved using the software that you discovered you're on the hook to support? On average, none. How about the guy that runs the division that made the software? He's the one with the new Ferrari and that collection of Ferraris. Separation of risk from reward. It's a really great concept. What if I were able to do something like sell a lot of something? I don't know, let's call them houses, right? And then take all of the risk for maintaining the payments on those houses and bundle them up into something. Let's hypothetically call them CDOs and sell those around and just see how that works. That couldn't go wrong, could it? Just pass off arbitrary risk and see what happens. So moving away from this sense of I'm just going to shuffle things around. So what I want to do now is kind of explore and add a little bit of extra geekiness, because I really feel like you haven't gotten the Chris Jackson session if there's no geekiness, but it's a 200 session. So I was like, how do I do a 200 session? That's kind of not Chris Jackson-y per se, but it needs to be geeky enough. So I figured, oh, well, I'd do math. Turns out that the Tech Ed deck template doesn't have a math slide, so I made my own. But I want to do some of that math. I'll pass. Thank you, though, for asking. And start to think about what is it that drives compatibility decisions? Because we do things based upon these perfectionist thoughts, and if we think them through and do the math, we end up with something that is truly insanity. Let's start with the concept of I need to find it all, rationalize it all, this process that Microsoft itself has been advocating. Collect, analyze, test, and remediate. Let's talk about collect and analyze if I'm being thorough, comprehensive, and looking at everything in the Office realm. Office 2003 to Office 2010. A lot of people are doing that transition. How many Office documents exist in the average enterprise? About 25 million on average. Right? Oh, you should see web. Number of unique web URLs that are browsed to, if you collect long enough, is in the hundreds of millions in a large enterprise. I don't know about mid-size, not because I don't love mid-sized people, but because I don't work in that space. I'm one guy and I can only go so many places, so if you have a lot of seats, I'm much more likely to see you. When we think about the cost purely of rationalization, let's compare that to the cost of just asking someone how many things I should be going and testing. So if we look at the number of docs, so for every doc, to rationalize it and determine if I should test it, I'm going to multiply that by the rate for my rationalizer by the time I take. And I want to make sure that this is less than the rate of my business leader times the time they take to just give me a list. That's the mathematical comparison I'm making, because I've got two choices. Either A, if you want me to manage it, you can tell me what you want me to manage, or B, I can look at everything and find the stuff you want me to manage and you can be not involved. Of course, the business leaders love option B because they're humans, also lazy. If we take a look at that, like, all right, let's assume that our business leaders are getting $300 an hour, and they're going to spend 8 hours each, and there's 100 of them, pretty big company, to figure that out. And we compare that to my 25 million docs, and I'm going to outsource this. Maybe I'll get these people, they're onshore people, so $100 an hour, and I'm going to look at that for about 5 minutes apiece to determine whether or not it's critical. So if I multiply that out, this ends up being $240,000 to go through and analyze that. And if I multiply this out, this ends up being $200 million. So I've got a choice. I can find it all and rationalize it for you for the low, low price of $200 million. Or you can tell me and it'll cost the business $240,000. Which one should you do? And then, of course, there's the immediate objection of, wow, you're paying these people too much. Those consultants, oh, they're always wasting money. Let's get cheaper people. Great. Let's snipe them from the employment line at McDonald's and get minimum wage people. That'll do really well. Let's keep going, and let's say we're going to do $7.25 an hour. I think that's minimum wage. Is that right? So if I multiply it by $7.25 an hour, I bring that dollar figure down quite a bit. It ends up being $14,500,000 for my minimum wage people to go through and do that work for me. Which is better than $200 million, but I'm still worse off than I was by just asking. So then you think, wow, you're spending too much time going through and doing that work. So if you do the math to figure out how much time do I get to spend with my minimum wage people to determine if these things are important, and it turns out that that answer is 4.77 seconds. So I have minimum wage people scalped from McDonald's looking at every single document in the organization for just under 5 seconds each, hundreds of documents a day. How good of a job do you think they're going to do? And therefore, should I ever take that path? Doesn't make sense. That's the kind of math that we end up doing, right? I use calculator all the time. I had one customer who was going through and saying, listen, here's what I want to do. I want to collect ACT data from every single computer in the organization for 30 days because that's going to solve my problem. And I said, all right. I don't know that that's a solution to your problem, because if we look at what they were going to do, the average amount of time it takes to process an ACT log is 17 seconds as of Act 5.03, which is what they were running. 17 seconds per log, and if I'm running that to upload every 8 hours, that's 3 times a day, they're going to run it for 30 days, and they were going to run that on 100,000 desktops, so that's how many seconds it would take for them to process that data, which is kind of hard to understand. So it's that many minutes, that many hours, that many days, that many years. Perhaps it's not worth waiting nearly 5 years to get that data. With everything I go to collect, there's a cost to doing it. And the same is true for understanding the value of my software. I talk a good game about, hey, the value, how much is it going to cost you if it fails, and blah, blah, blah. Measuring that cost is non-trivial. And it interferes with understanding what that cost is in the first place. But going through and doing some of this math helps to understand when you're doing something that's insane. Here's another interesting one, also down the line of Office. When you migrate from Office 2003 to Office 2010, do you have to update all of your documents to the latest file formats? We'll open doc files. We'll open XLS files. You don't have to open them. When might you? Well, if you want to use new features, but if you want to use the new features, you're actively editing the document, so you can do it when you open it. The other argument is it saves disk space. Less disk space with the new file format. And they do all the fancy math to determine how much disk space you might possibly save. Right? And it turns out that this amount of disk space, they don't carry that on because they can give these big numbers that sound very impressive, but I need to figure out what is the cost of that disk space. And the cost, as it turns out, is changing over time. In the formula is 10 to the negative 0.2502 times the year minus 1980 plus 6.304. It's exponential. And it's going down over time because disks continue to get cheaper. The average cost savings for the typical enterprise, if they convert all of their documents, is $14,000 over a period of 10 years. If you run it all the way to completion. They'll throw you gigs. Sounds impressive. Then they'll sell you a $100,000 project to save you $14,000. Does that make sense? That's the kind of thing we want to avoid by doing our homework and doing the math. And this is not complicated math. This is mostly addition. But it's the sense of moving away from the idea of being a perfectionist and having everything being lined up and instead becoming more agile. When I think about some of the top technical things that you could be doing, number one, on any Microsoft platform, nearly everything we do, you can put in something about compatibility. In the web, XUA compatible on everything will continue to give it that rendering engine, and that's goodness. For Windows apps, you can put in the application manifest, starting with Windows 7, which version you're designed for, which means the OS can help to keep you working. And this compatibility metadata helps to ensure you against an unknown future. If you are moving from IE8 to IE9, the number of applications that have not been fixable using an XUA compatible meta tag, which means just give me a different rendering engine, that have come to me, the escalation point for enterprise software, so public web servers are totally different. I don't look at those. I look at web software. Total number, 4, worldwide since we shipped. Everything else, I could just turn the dial, XUA compatible, get it done. It's still a touch point. I had to do something, but it's really easy. And if I had put the tag in for 8, I wouldn't have had to touch it again for 9. And I wouldn't have to touch it again for 10. making me more agile. Because the dark ages, I don't want to keep living in. I want to think about putting in a management process, determining where my problems are coming from and addressing those. Not just some pie in the sky thing. You know, having a global view and enterprise architects who see big pictures is great, right? But let's fix some of the tactical problems. We've got strategy and tactics, and we need to implement them both. Let's put in the tactics to manage it so that I can begin to support those strategies. And finally, the biggest advice, which is sort of odd because our argument is, hey, it's super configurable, is don't configure it unless you have to. Because the more you configure it, the harder it is. Now, I still configure mine. Think about what you do on your machine personally. I used to spend close to a day getting my machine tuned just right. You know what I do now? I turn off that stupid hide file extensions for known file types, and that's it. I go with Windows. I make one configuration change because it doesn't add value. There's a cost to changing. And if the cost is not made up for an ROI, you shouldn't do it. So if I think about the meta learnings here, understand this is an emotional task. People get attached to it. A lot of the words we used are emotionally charged words. Understand that we're dealing with humans who don't like change. One of the greatest differences I've seen in the approach that we use within Microsoft is that we no longer change things just to change them. We try not to. A great quote from Chris Yu, who runs our Office compatibility team, says, here's the goal we have for new versions of Office. Change is bad unless it's great. We want to wow people and make it truly great and find some way to understand they're afraid, they don't want change, they don't want to be bad at their job because it's suddenly different, but they're also consumers who want new things and who think of technology as a status symbol, and we want to support that. Allow for trial and error, measure, track, improve, understand that you're not a statistic, but that you do have your own statistics that will drive what matters to you, and think about how always to become more agile. The goal being, don't build another giant pyramid to last for a decade like you did for XP, but build something designed to change. So with that, I would like to thank you all for coming. Hopefully this was a good best practices introduction. And we've got sessions on Act 6. We've got a hardcore nerd session and all kinds of other fun stuff going on through the rest of the week. Have a great tech ed, and we hope to see you at other sessions.